This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working building in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Need a professional place to work from? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com.
This week, Meat and Three is taking you to market and all over the world, from Newfoundland to Tunisia.
Well, a lot of us think of, you know, the British Empire trading things like spices and sugar and silk. But you write that it actually began with salt cod from Newfoundland.
There was a port closure in Tunisia, which was horrible. I mean, it was months, boats just sitting on the water waiting to go, and they couldn't go anywhere.
And we'll learn about how markets have changed, whether because of their customers or the climate.
A few years ago, something around 10 years, it was totally different.
It almost manifests itself to almost smelling like an old fire pit. When you, when you put it out, it has that sort of charcoal-y smell to it. It's not good for wine.
Join us this week on Meat and Three for our global market tour. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the pod.
Yeah, it's me, Marissa.
And Adam. We're natural disasters. We haven't done that in a couple episodes, I've noticed.
We haven't,
like, synchronized.
Well, now we just did, in case, sort of. In case anyone was missing it. All right, so let's get to what we're drinking today. We are drinking the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly.
This is a relatively new project, I believe, right?
This is new.
Is this the inaugural vintage?
I think maybe. I can't speak for certain, but it is from Stagiaire.
Stagiaire, Stagiaire.
And we are drinking the Sweat Dreams, which has one of the best labels I've seen in a long time.
It's one of those, you know, those corkscrews that, like, everyone seems to have one for some reason, but nobody ever buys them. They're the one where you, like, it's like a little,
the almost literal corkscrew. It's like you're screwing it from the top.
That and then can you also have, like, the little arms.
Yes, it's got the arms. So it's one of those corkscrews, like,
drinking
in, like, an undone blazer or something. I don't know.
He looks a little disheveled.
He's disheveled. I like him, though, and it's really pretty. I really like it. So
it kind of looks like it was done with marker, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so it's a Chardonnay and Muscat blend from Contra Costa. Stagiaire is a winemaker named Brent Mayo, I believe.
M-A-Y-E-A-U-X. I think Mayo.
Mayo?
Mayo?
Mayo.
Mayo.
Brent. His name is Brent. He's making wine in Santa Cruz. And you know what? I'm into it.
Yeah, I think he makes wine with Sturm. If I am recalling that correctly.
So if you look at this this lovely blend of Chardonnay and Muscat, it's got kind of this, like, really bright, like, but also hazy kind of Meyer lemon peel color going on.
You know, I mean this in the most positive way. I feel like I say that all the time. It's kind of got a Coors Light color.
Coors Light color?
Yeah, or like Miller High Life. It's got, like, this slightly orange tinge to the yellow, like a gold. Let's go gold.
All right, yeah.
It's got, like, this golden color.
It's got a goldness to it. I guess I just always drink those things out of cans, and I never think about what they actually look like.
Miller High Life is really what I meant, not Coors Light. Miller High Life.
Which I definitely know too well.
In the bottles.
Yes.
It kind of has that color to
it. Yes, I know exactly what those look like because I used to play Edward 40 Hands, which was a bad idea.
With those?
Yeah, it was just all bad. Anyways, it smells like...
It smells like Muscat. The Muscat is really there on the nose.
Yeah, it's wildly fruity on the nose, but not in a bad way. Not in that perfumey, aromatic, like, ooh, this could be like my mom's old perfume I found in a drawer.
Just very aromatic.
Just very aromatic in a really clean way. Very strong, but very clean. I love it. It smells like a tropical island.
It really does. It smells almost like a daiquiri.
Yeah, with, like, very clean air. Like, place that doesn't have pollution.
Like a vacation.
This is not drinking Miller High Life's on Huntington Beach for
no,
sure.
No, this is
you're in a pristine, like,
untouched. By man.
Yeah, and it tastes like
Chardonnay.
It does. It does have, like, a really nice Chardonnay quality to it, which I guess is, like, it has nice citrus, but still has a good amount of tropical notes on it. But
it's
again,
really
very
fucking good.
It's really fucking good. I'm not gonna
hats off.
There's two of us.
Yeah, hats off to Brent because you knocked it out of the park with this.
I don't feel
like we say this very often on the pod.
No, yeah, this is truly a really cool wine, and it's a I love that this is from California. It really does like turn on its head like what you think of like Chardonnay Muscat. It's like a little mind bendy.
Fucking great.
It's really good. I'm not gonna lie, this is actually like my third bottle of it. I've just been like not posting about it because I'm like I want to keep drinking it.
It's exceptional.
Mm. All right. Well, let's get to our topic of today, which is dry farming.
Dry farming, the opposite of wet farming.
Yes. So dry farming is something that's talked about a lot in natural wine and is something that a lot of people consider a pillar of making natural wine.
Yeah. Before we get too detailed, though, or into it, I wanted to give just a little primer. Dry farming and farming in general is an incredibly complex and integral and it's not an easy conversation. We are doing the easy conversation
this is like us just kind of giving the
overview
and then we're gonna talk
because it's a very very complex issue.
We don't need our DMs full of like, hey,
yeah,
farming is intricate as fuck,
you didn't talk about rootstock, you didn't talk about soil type
this is
and
just,
drainage and all that
there
sort
are
stuff.
Literal books just on this subject
on this,
but we want
people, I think there's probably people who get like master's degrees.
Absolutely. So this is us just kind of giving an overview of like what it is, how it relates to natural wine, and eventually
is it important?
And is it important? Yeah, especially as we deal with climate change. So to start, what is dry farming? It is exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's farming without the use of irrigation.
Yes. So that means you're relying entirely on the weather. Like you really need
rainfall or underwater wells.
Yeah.
Or
like snow, I'm sure, melting and coming down some rivers, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Or
water. It needs water from nature. It needs water.
It needs water.
That's coming down from the sky and getting into the earth all on its goddamn own.
Yeah. And the grapes are seeking that water out on their own. They're not being bottle fed water from some sort of irrigation system.
Totally. This just used to be how farming was done back in the old days.
Well, yeah, for the most part, I think a lot of people, the reason why grapes proliferated was because they didn't require irrigation.
Yeah.
So when you look at grapes probably going through the course of history, and I bet you, this is just a hypothesis, I might be wrong, if you looked at where they were planted over time, and sort of the history of it, I would be willing to bet that it was places where you wouldn't need to irrigate.
Yeah, absolutely. No, rainier regions.
Right, and it was probably, in all honesty, a crop that you could, for the most part, relatively ignore.
Yeah, you could just like let it do its thing.
You could let it grow, and you could let it happen, and then you could go and harvest it.
Totally, totally.
There probably wasn't a lot of pruning. There probably wasn't a lot of stuff. It was just, oh, we can plant all these grapes on this hillside, and we don't have to worry about it for 10 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And then we just harvest it, and we can make wine from it, would be my guess.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a good guess. Another thing with like a lot of people dry farm because yes, it is a pillar of natural wine. It's something that people think is a very important part of natural wine making. But also too, like irrigation costs a lot of money.
Yeah, to build those systems.
To build those systems and to supply water is not cheap. So a lot of people need to do it also for financial reasons. And you know, since we're drinking a California wine right now, I think it's important to note that less than 10% of California dry farms.
Yes, it's not a large. I mean, there are a lot. You hear about dry farming happening in California. I was going to say
but
Los
still,
Angeles. But when you think about less than 10%.
And when you think about all of the wines that are made in California, it's pretty insane.
And on a even crazier point, it's something like 16,000 tons of water is used per acre.
That was wrong.
Is it wrong?
Yeah, I was saving that stat for later.
Oh, well, we can go back to that.
We'll just cut. Yeah, that stat was wrong. But anyways, we'll get back to
It's not wrong.
It is. It's not tons. It's gallons.
Gallons. That's what I meant.
Also, well, now I got to. All right. Now, hold on. The actual correct statistic, which was in another portion of my
I just felt like
outline,
it was in a good spot.
I know. Okay. I know. Is that it saves 16,000 gallons per acre.
Yeah.
annually.
That's what I was. So what I was saying is, imagine. So if only 10%, if less than 10% is dry farming, think about how many gallons of water.
Yeah, especially if you ever drive through Napa or Sonoma,
or like, Central Valley,
or the Central Valley. Like, you got to think like that's probably like thousands and thousands, unfathomable,
millions of gallons,
millions of gallons. So, anyways, that's. I don't know.
I threw off Marissa so bad.
Know. I'm like, God damn it.
All right, so let's go back to it. So we're at the pros of dry. Is that where we're going?
So, yes. Let's first talk about the pros of dry farming. The first one is that it's the truest expression of a vintage, like in its honest to goodness form. You know, like it's the truest expression of the weather, the soil, the vines, the grapes of that year, because it is the exact product of its environment. They didn't do anything to water it.
Yeah, other than choosing the grape and choosing the location and maybe some pruning and some other stuff, the grape is relatively wild.
Yeah, exactly. And is a direct influence of the climate and terroir, if you will, around it.
I'm going to use an analogy of like, it's like a, when they do, not zoos, but like when they do, where they have gated areas in Africa or places where they want to keep like elephants
like
and
lions. Like
wildlife
preserves?
That's what I'm, yeah. It's kind of like the wildlife preserve of growing to some degree. Like, you're keep making sure that the grapes stay safe and that they're okay and they're not being poached or whatever, but they're relatively wild to some degree.
Yeah, and they're relying on the rain.
Nature.
And, yeah, exactly. Another pro of dry farming is it... because you're not watering these plants, the vines have to be way stronger to survive.
Oh, yes.
Which makes them really hardy and more resistant to disease. And also, like, and the reason that is because these roots have to dig down deep to be able to find water.
They have to seek water.
Yeah, they have to seek water during parts of the year that aren't typically raining. So, you know, dry farming creates stronger plants in general.
And they have to be more, I mean, I don't know, I was going to say conscious, but I don't think they're conscious, but who knows. But they also have to sort of be how they're using their resources. So
yes.
Not only are they looking for water, but how much are they going to produce of the grapes? How much, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is like because of the stress that this puts on the vines to go down and like find the water, and sometimes these are in like very, you know, in soil types that are very rocky or whatever. This puts a lot of stress on the vines and on then the grapes that it produces. It produces like less grapes that are smaller but denser and more flavorful than if they were irrigated.
Yeah, I think it's really simple just to think about dilution, right? Like if you have something, it's like concentration versus dilution.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you're making soup and you add a bunch of water to it and you don't reduce it or something, it's going to be a less flavorful
Yeah,
soup.
Less flavorful.
But
absolutely.
If you like reduce, and it's like a really concentrated.
I think that's a really good analogy.
The flavor's like much more concentrated.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, this is why it's really important for people that are dry farming to take into consideration like the grapes that they have or are planting, and also the vineyard sites, because like, you know, the plants, the vines need to be able to reach water underneath.
And I just want to preface again, like, we're using broad strokes. I know there's somebody out there who's like, oh, we use drip irrigation. We only use drip irrigation when it's absolutely necessary. We're like 75% dry farming, but then like if it gets 115 degrees for
we're gonna
days,
get to all that. You're
I'm
like
just, I know I'm jumping around. It's just I don't know. All I can think about is
all right. Well, this is just a good lesson to all of our listeners about how I try to keep this train on the go.
They all thought that it was Marissa that made this thing a wild
how
ride.
Am
but
I
it's the, always me.
I know. I don't know how I ended up being the straight man in anything.
Well, you're not
but
the straight man, but we're definitely like
I gotta be like I've gotta be the producer, anyways. And now
you actively work to manage your ADHD.
Yes.
I don't even acknowledge mine.
Yes, this is true. And then I was going to say what was next on my very well thought out outline was that dry farming is better for the environment because it saves approximately 16,000 gallons per acre every year, which again, as we said, is a lot. And like, I think that's part of the reason too. It's like a big part of the natural wine community and ethos because it is better for the environment. Like, you're saving water. Like, not it's great. Like, I'm all about saving water, especially because we live in California.
Yeah, we grew up in a
drought.
In just also, like an era where we were like, turn off your sink while you're brushing your teeth.
Absolutely.
Don't take a shower that's longer than like 8 minutes.
We're still, like, I mean, like they said that we're out of a drought, but we're not.
And we live in it, being in Southern California, I live with the concept.
We're not even supposed to have water here.
Like, that's true.
We're not like literally.
We steal all our water.
Yeah, we steal all of our water. And then what's funny is that now there's companies.
North California.
Well, now there's all these companies that are now stealing all of our water. So it's all going to be owned
by. Are
you
talking about like Calistoga and stuff?
I'm talking about like the Palm Wonderful Company, or I guess the Wonderful Company.
Yeah.
They own like so much of California's water.
You know what else they own?
Fiji.
And Justin Wine in Paso Robles.
Interesting. Well, we'll just keep on going.
Bum, bum. I wonder if they irrigate. For abso-fucking-lutely.
Oh, abso-fucking-lutely, yeah. I wonder if they irrigate with Fiji water. So let's go into some of the cons of irrigation. So like we were talking about with the
Doing pros of dry farming and then cons of irrigation?
Yeah, because, I mean, because we're gonna talk about why irrigation can be good.
Okay.
After this.
Okay. Okay.
Jesus Christ Almighty, you guys! This is what I deal with all the time. Usually, I'm saying cut at this point, but you know what? We're keeping it.
We're keeping it.
So, anyways, some of the cons of irrigation are like, let's talk about irrigation, like why you know it's not the best, even though we already kind of went into that. But so with irrigation, like how dry farming, the roots have to like go deep and like, you know, to find water. Plants that are irrigated don't have to do that.
No, they're coddled.
Yeah,
kind of. They're soft, if you will. They're a little bit less
industrious.
Yeah, exactly. And just like
they're not
anybody,
survivors.
Just like anybody, any person who is coddled and like you know the smallest.
They don't know struggle.
No, the smallest thing can shake their foundation and cause them to freak out and who knows. And
well,
like,
that's also because of physically they don't have the root system to keep them steady. But also, and that's because like they're getting water from the top.
I'm having like this conversation is like there's so much analogy to like
people
and like this idea of like having culture and having roots and like how there's like a stability in like our culture and in our roots and then like
absolutely
what's happening in America and like this idea of like people not having
people are
roots.
Honestly just getting irrigated with bullshit all
absolutely
day,
they're just irrigated no culture they've got no roots
they're just being irrigated a bunch of bullshit that they now think is like their culture or
and so like any little thing fucking
upsets them
and kill and like absolutely
we're not gonna,
destroys them.
Yes. So, but because these you know irrigated because irrigated vines like don't have this really strong root structure and they've never struggled. They've never had to go find the water for themselves. They're really susceptible to drought.
Yeah, and I believe also diseases.
Yeah,
they're just like susceptible to problems.
We talked about this before the pod, but it reminds me of like rich people.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
You know, it's like, oh, if you have everything given to you your entire life and you've had every opportunity always.
Yeah. Not being able to get a reservation in a restaurant
is
the fucking end of the world.
Is the end of the world.
Yeah. It's a big problem.
Yeah. Turn the page. You can cut that part.
Oh no, we're keeping everything.
So another part about irrigation that's actually really interesting is that irrigation was a big part of the shift in what grapes were like kind of going back particularly to California. Irrigation was a part of the big shift in what grapes were planted here, you know, pre-1960s.
Yeah, like in the 1850s, 1860s, when people started like planting a lot of grapes in California and on, they chose, just like in Europe or other parts of the world where they were like, okay, we're being conscious with the grapes that we're planting in the environment.
We're considering,
makes,
we're considering the variety and we're considering the vineyard sites.
Like the Bordeaux, the five Bordeaux varieties exist in Bordeaux, not just because of people in Bordeaux like to drink them. It's because they made sense in that environment.
Yeah, because Bordeaux is a particularly rainy area.
Right,
or
like Riesling or wherever, you know, in these older places. And even in the New World, I think originally that's how it was, and that's
absolutely
how we have sort of these heritage grapes in the New World that are no longer here,
or it's something like Zinfandel. Like Zinfandel was the example you brought up.
Yeah, Zinfandel Pais or Mission.
Yeah.
Alicante Bouchette.
These are grapes that did well in this environment.
Right. And people weren't irrigating back then.
And people weren't irrigating.
So they were, right. They were planting grapes that made sense in California or in Chile or wherever they were in Mexico. And they didn't have to irrigate, and those grapes existed there for that reason.
Totally. And then once irrigation became a thing, like post-60s, like that's when we started to see things like all these French varieties like Chardonnay.
Yeah, I don't know which one came first. I don't know whether it was the style came first and the irrigation came after came first.
But it's very interesting, though, that like all of these grapes that now, for example, California is known for, like Chardonnay, Cabernet, Pinot Noir, like these are actually grapes that do not thrive in this environment and need a ton of water. Like they thrive in Burgundy
where they get like 30 inches of rain a year or something, and not in California that gets like 7.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like you have to irrigate them. And like, so it kind of makes sense that once, and again, like we're not sure if it was the style that came first or the irrigation, but irrigation is what made it possible for California to be able to produce these varieties.
And I'm not saying, and I know again, and I'm not saying we're not saying that like Pinot Noir should never be grown in California. And
definitely not. We're drinking
Chardonnay.
Yeah, we're drinking a Chardonnay blend right now. That's amazing.
Obviously, California is a very big state, and there's lots of places.
But Napa.
No, but I also like
Napa's like 100 degrees right now.
Like when people are like, well, even still, when people are like, oh, Chardonnay is really popular. Let's graft Chardonnay onto all of these old Zinfandel rootstocks because no one wants to drink Zinfandel anymore or whatever, Alicante Bouchette or whatever. And so, you know, you're in Paso Robles or you're someplace where it just doesn't even make any sense to have these varieties. And people are doing it anyway because of fashion.
Because they're able to.
Right.
Because if they didn't have irrigation, those vines would just die.
Yeah. Or make really fucking whacked out weird wine.
Or make really... maybe delicious raisins? Maybe Paso Robles is like, should be just doing raisins. We don't know. Who's to say?
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with 2 microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
Adam said previously, you know, when you're watering or when you're irrigating, like it does dilute the grape's flavors. Like I think that the analogy of
soup
and reduction, like reducing it down. I think makes so much sense, you know. Whereas like when you're irrigating, like the grapes are watered down. Like, also, they just have, I think that they, again, going back to, like, the stressors,
they're just,
you know?
Boring.
Yeah, well, they don't even have to, like, and I know that you don't believe in terroir, but, like, those, like, irrigated vines don't even have to really have terroir, because they don't even have to, like, really go down into the soil to do anything. You know what I mean?
No, totally, totally.
Like they just get to hang out up top. Again,
you can kind of fake your terroir.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're talking about extreme irrigation in this.
Yeah,
sense.
yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about, like...
Because there's a lot of different, you know, like, there's some people that do some light... Well, and we're going to get
like
it.
Like, drip irrigation and all these
different... Yeah, absolutely. And so, like, kind of the conversation, like, of this, and the reason we wanted to give you the background on it is because I... personally, I think that with climate change, dry farming is going to be, I think it's a really important talking point about whether it should be a pillar of like natural wine or not.
Yeah, and sorry, excuse me. Classic
classic burp sesh.
Yeah. No, and like we were talking about, we didn't bring it up, but so in Europe, there's actually places where it's illegal to.
Yes, or it was illegal. It used to be illegal in Burgundy, Bordeaux, Barolo, Barbaresco.
All the bees.
All the bees.
And other places. Rioja, I think anywhere that you think of when you think of like world class wine in Europe, they don't irrigate. I'm sure there's exceptions.
But well, now they're having to make exceptions because these regions that were previously so rainy, like for example, like Burgundy, very, very traditionally a very, very, very rainy.
Problems with ripening it.
Like literally they made irrigation illegal because they're like, yo, water's already a problem. Like we do not need more water in these regions. Yeah. But now with climate change, these regions are getting warmer. And so now they're actually allowing some of these regions that used to be illegal to do irrigation to do some light irrigating in order to be able to continue making wine.
Yeah, and also probably to maintain a certain amount of continuity, because in those regions, you know, if you're making Burgundy, you want Burgundy to taste like Burgundy to some degree. And so you have to, if you're used to 30 inches of rain annually and all of a sudden it's down to 25 or it's down to 20 or 18, and you're like, well, now the grapes don't taste like Burgundy anymore and things are sort of changing. By irrigating, you're sort of maintaining a status quo of what Burgundy
and a lot of people need to do that for their business, you know.
And a lot of people want to continue drinking Burgundy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know that I've talked about when I was in Italy before, like in August of 2017. So 2017 was the hottest year that Italy had in 200 years, right? And so this winery, Tiberi, you know, I was there in 2017. They did not use irrigation, like, you know, whatever. Yeah. But after 2017, when I visited them in 2018, they had installed a drip system because it was getting to the point where they were having to choose between lightly irrigating or losing their crops entirely.
There's a winery, I won't call them out, but they're in a region in California that dry farms and very, very dogmatic about it. And like they're very hard lined, and 1 year lost all their crops. Was not able to make wine from their vineyards.
Yeah,
or only made like one barrel or two barrels, like such a minute amount that they had to buy grapes all over California in order to stay in business. And you know, that's a big risk.
No, and like, you know, it's wild because I don't know if climate change. I mean, honestly, we all should do everything we can about climate change in our daily lives. But the truth is, unless like the top 10 companies in the world like change their entire practices like tomorrow, we're kind of fucked.
Right.
So my thing is like also like, so with these wine growers, how are they going to be able to afford either to continue depending on dry farm, or two, how can they even afford to irrigate if they wanted to?
Yeah, all of a sudden they have to install irrigation systems and then on top of it spend however much it costs. I can't even imagine.
To not only get the system in, but
the
also
water.
But the water.
Water is really fucking expensive.
It's getting more expensive, especially as it's becoming more and more privatized.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's like, all right.
So our wine goes up in price, I guess.
Yeah, probably. But also too, like, does that mean, so dry farming is such like a pillar of natural wine, but like, I don't know if it will be able to continue to be if climate change keeps going the way that it is.
Well, that brings up a big question actually, which is, ultimately, if you do everything correct in the vineyard and in the winery, but you didn't dry farm, is your wine natural?
I feel like we're going to get to a place where dry farming is not going to be as essential in terms of like the ethos as it is now and it has been previously, because I just don't think that people are going to be able to make wine unless they do some sort of irrigation. And I'm not saying like, you know, full blown, but like, even like we're talking about even like drip systems,
yeah.
You know, that's what Tiberi was like. Oh, we only did it six times.
Yeah.
You know, like,
right.
Like,
we didn't use 16,000 gallons per acre. We used 1,000 gallons
over an entire year.
Yeah.
And so, and so there are a lot of people that are kind of doing it that way, where it's like, yes, we have the irrigation system set up, but we only
it's like
use
in
it
in emergency only.
Yeah, exactly. But does that disqualify them?
I mean, there's some people that say that about pesticides too.
But I mean, I kind of think that about pesticides. because there's natural ways to ward off bugs.
No, but I'm saying that there are people who will exploit the natural wine ethos by saying we only do it when it's necessary, but it just so happens that every vintage it's necessary. So when you're dealing with these people who are using drip irrigation or irrigation, they go, oh, we only use it when it's necessary.
Is that any
different? How do we determine that when it's necessary? Do we just trust them?
Well, I think you have to, but I also think that like the difference between pesticides and water is that like pesticides harm the earth and people.
No, I'm not saying I'm not making that correlation. I'm making the correlation between honesty of when. So you're trusting those winemakers
But aren't we already trusting the winemakers?
Well, that's what certification does, I guess.
Yeah, but a lot of people can't afford certification.
Yeah, no, it's a big problem.
It's a really big problem. So we're already putting a lot of trust in winemakers. And, you know, as someone that's obviously very involved in the community, there are a lot of rumors of a lot of people doing a lot of things in all sorts of places. I mean,
that's like all the conversations you have late at night when everyone's been drinking.
Yeah, it's like, did you hear that so-and-so is doing blah, blah, blah? And you're like, what? No way.
Yeah.
And then you like hit up the winemaker and you're like, did you do da-da-da? And they're like, fuck no, who told you that? Yeah. And then it's this whole thing. So it's like everyone already feels like there's already a lot of people that feel like winemakers are lying about certain things. And like for me, I just have to drink the wine and trust it and trust the winemakers. Like, I have to trust them to be honest with me. And, like, that's getting harder and harder because of climate change. And we talked about it before, but, like, not only are things changing in the vineyard, but they're changing in the cellar. Like, these are people that are, you know, have maybe been making wine the same way for decades, and now all of a sudden their cave is up 5-10 degrees.
Right, which means their native yeast that they're using is not acclimated, and maybe even... So what's happening is like we need to get into this, but basically what's happening is the yeast that we're doing the fermenting the most amount of it maybe are dying, and there's new ones coming
in. And there's new bacteria. So it's like, so climate change is actually like a huge issue for natural wine in a lot of different ways. Like, we could do an entire episode on that.
Is this a climate change pod? This isn't a dry farming pod anymore.
I think it's good that we explain what dry farming is so people understand it. But I do think that it's going to have to. We're going to have to become more lenient if we want these winemakers to survive, or. Is it natural wine Darwinism? Like,
yeah, is natural wine just inevitably going to die?
Or
like us?
Or is it like that natural wine in certain areas is going to die?
Can't exist.
Can't exist. But then it allows another region to thrive. Like, for example, like maybe California in 10 years isn't able to, you know, do all this wine.
Right. Maybe people are going up to higher altitudes.
Yeah. Or like Vermont then has like that space or whatever. Yeah. So maybe it is something that
BC, I was in Canada, and there was like, they were talking about how like...
Yeah, but we can't even get any of those wines, so I'm like, fuck that.
No, but I, you know, they were talking, and they're like, it's getting better and better each year, and it's kind of... And England, I've heard England say that, our vintages are getting better and better each year, and where it's like, you know, people in Loire are like, oh, it's getting fucking worse and harder.
Oh, yeah.
And then like, people farther north are going, or probably pretty far south, are going, oh, it's getting better and better. So like...
Yeah, it's a really interesting.
Is like getting thicker.
Yeah, it feels like it. I mean, considering we've been dealing with like 70% humidity in LA
and triple digit degrees, on and off for the last couple of weeks,
it's really not chill at all. But it does kind of bring up this again, like kind of going back to what I was talking about, like climate change. Is going to make us question a lot of things, and because wines are going to change along with the climate, so like it's impossible for them not to, and so I think it's going to put a lot of like people's ethos and sticking points and these, you know, these hard lines into question, because do you want like I don't want my favorite winemakers to go completely broke and not be able to produce wine, and like, what are they going to do?
I don't know. That's a good question. What do more people want in the natural wine community? Would they rather their favorite winemakers cease producing if they could not hold the standard at which they do now, or to be a little bit more lenient in their standards, but to continue producing.
It's interesting because a very, 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 very prominent woman in the natural wine world, I won't say her name in case she doesn't want me to, you know, but I like went broke. I've gone broke doing my job, basically, because I have these very, very high standards of like how the wines that I'm going to put in Bon Appetit need to have, like, they need to be the most stable, like the most like little bottle variation. I have to drink it at least 3 times before I write about it, because I can't have someone in Minnesota that's never had natural wine before having a bad experience as their first time.
Well, you had that experience recently with the, something we drank several
bottles
of.
No, the Corto Caminos.
Yeah, and then like you got all these people who were like, it's mousy, it's mousy, it's mousy.
And
it's
I was
mousy.
Like, dude, I drank 5 bottles of it, but okay. And again, like you can't control everything. But the point of this is that this woman that's one of the major leaders in natural wine, when I told her that, I was like, dude, I've gone basically broke because I don't accept samples. Because I want my integrity and my criticism of wines to be, you know, I don't want to feel like I owe anyone favors, whatever, whatever. And she was like, Marissa, you are worth so much more to the community being able to survive in it than you being like this wild idealist. Like, ask for fucking samples when you need fucking samples. Like, if you're broke and you can't continue like talking about these wines or writing about them, you're not.
It's better to have you as a participant.
It's better to have you as a participant. So thinking about it that way, which was like a hard pill for me to swallow, being like, oh, like, and I still don't really ask anyone for samples. I still kind of would rather be broke than ask for them. But, you know, it for me, that perspective is like, then yes, I'd rather someone do light irrigating than go out completely. You know, like if that also, especially if that's the difference between them, like, because what are they going to do? A lot of them, their entire lives have been dedicated to natural wine, and their families, you know, like their heritage, their roots, like, you know, both physically and metaphorically speaking, you know, like, so it's, does that all go away because irrigating like excludes them, or it's crazy.
I don't know. No, it's a really good question, because it sort of. It puts into question kind of everything.
Everything. It really does. And like, and this is why I haven't tried to be dogmatic.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's certain things I'm dogmatic about. Like, I don't write about wines that, you know, have added yeast and, you know, I don't like to write about anything that has more than 10 to 20 parts of sulfur added. You know, I have my own little kind of guidelines, but at the same time, like, I feel like we're entering a time where I think that we have to be more flexible.
Yeah, I mean...
And I think that this is where transparency is going to become fucking pivotal.
That's where I agree. And if we're going to... I think we're getting close to the end of this pod. And if I want to end with anything, I think it's transparency. And if you irrigated or you did some drip irrigation, or you bought some grapes from somewhere, just tell us.
Just say it, because that...
If you added 30 parts per million, if you did a little bit of filtering because of something, if you did something, just talk about it.
Talk about it, because that's going to...
Be honest. Be open.
Be honest and open and talk about it, because the thing is like, we have to kind of like, we have to destigmatize winemakers having to adapt to their new environment.
God, I can't believe I'm going to say this. We need to destigmatize capitalism, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We live in a capitalist society, and in order for us to appreciate the people that continue to make the products that we want, we need to get over the fact that they're capitalists, because they are.
Well,
and we need
all
to
are.
Stop pretending that our favorite winemakers are these dream people that live in some sort of bubble where capitalism and commerce don't exist.
It does, because they need us to buy the wine so that they can continue making
Correct.
It.
And they sell a product. And we need to get over it. We need to really strongly get over it. And we need to be... I'm not a capitalist.
Well,
I'm
not
a socialist.
Saying like get over it, but like just understand it and understand the world that we're a part of, and be like, I want, like, vote with your dollars, like, is a big thing that I talk about. And so it's like, we do live in a capitalist society. There's nothing there's no stopping that at this point. And like, we shouldn't pretend that we don't live in one. And we shouldn't pretend that like these winemakers are, you know, they aren't the bajillionaires in Napa that can like lose a vineyard.
And those are the people that charge the most.
Yeah. And like the people we're talking about, like Tiberi is like a very, very small family winery.
Yeah.
I forget how many hectares they have, but it's like under 10.
What about,
you know?
Brent?
Brent, yeah.
Brent Mayo?
Yeah, we think.
Yeah. How many bottles is that guy making?
Yeah, exactly. And like, I mean, I don't...
Am I going to be like, if someone tells me that Brent, that the grapes that he bought from were drip irrigated, am I going to be like, fuck him? No, of course not.
No.
I'm going to support him so that hopefully one day he can grow and we can all grow. And God damn it, where did this pod go?
This pod is going to where the exact place Natural Wine is going, where... literally everything is up for debate, and it's important that we talk about it.
Yeah.
And on that note,
it's about the roots.
Yeah, all it's right. About our roots.
All right.
All right.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.